One family split between the U.S. and Haiti, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. For a family living near Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, the money sent by relatives in America is a lifeline.
That's the only thing we can really rely on right now. If we didn't have that, I don't know what the situation would be.
But with the end of a special visa program for Haitians in the U.S., that lifeline is about to end. Also, the picture of a woman protesting from the roof of a car in Sudan connects big time with young Sudanese women here in America.
There's a nostalgic element to the photo, and it represents a certain kind of Sudanese empowered femininity.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In 2 days, the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy will be put on pause. That's what a federal judge ordered. The pause means that migrants seeking asylum at the border will no longer be forced to go back to Mexico and wait while their cases are processed in the U.S. The judge said that put asylum seekers at risk, living on the streets in Mexico without any cash or support. He also said that the policy created unnecessary hurdles to seeking legal help. From The World's Immigration Desk, Monica Campbell joins us from California to explain what this looks like for the people who are seeking asylum. Hey, Monica.
Hey, Marco.
You spoke with one man who is directly affected by this policy. Who is he? What's his story?
I spoke with a man named Denelson. He asked to not use his full name because his status is uncertain, and he doesn't want to have his full name out in public. He's 21 years old. He's from El Salvador, and he left there with his longtime girlfriend and their two little kids. And he said the gangs in El Salvador made life really difficult, but there was another reason they left. He said their oldest boy, he's 5 years old, is sick.
De nacimiento, que él solo tiene la mitad del corazón. Queremos buscar una nueva vida para él.
So he's telling me that his son was born with half a heart. He kept saying that, half a heart. And I asked him more, and it's clear that he was worried about his son having a heart condition, a medical condition, that he's sick, and that they couldn't find help for their son in El Salvador. And the dad thinks that his son will have a better shot at better medical care, staying alive in the United States.
And what happened when this family got to the U.S. border?
So they got to Tijuana about a week ago and asked for asylum at the border. They were all detained and then separated. The mom and her kids were put in one facility, and Denelson, the dad, was put in another facility for men only. Then he was sent back to Mexico. He says since he couldn't prove he was the dad or the husband because he's not married to his partner, they don't have the same last names, and he doesn't have the same last name as the kids. So he was sent back. And the mom and the kids weren't sent back to Mexico because they're not separating parents from the children, at least not en masse. And you can't send kids back to Mexico. So they remained in the U.S. So when I talked to him, he was alone in Mexico.
Pues ninguna vez.
Ninguna vez.
Desde que entramos ahí, perdimos el contacto desde que entramos ahí el jueves.
He's saying here that he hasn't talked to his family since they were separated. He doesn't know where they are in the United States. And Denelson doesn't have a lawyer. He's in another country, completely cut off. I mean, he had to borrow a phone to talk to me, and he's been sleeping on the streets. And it'll be another month before he has a court hearing in San Diego.
So what are the likely next steps for Denelson? And, looking at this Friday when Remain in Mexico is put on pause, will that affect him in any way?
It should affect him very directly. His next asylum hearing is in early May, and if he makes progress in that case, he'll remain in the United States instead of being returned back to Mexico again. So he'll remain in the United States. What happens after that is a little uncertain. He could remain detained, he could get deported, lose his case, or he could progress with his case, remain in the U.S., fight for asylum, and perhaps join his family. They may be on separate tracks. It's unsure when he and his family may see each other again.
Monica, why was this Remain in Mexico policy put in place at all?
Well, President Trump says there's this widespread fraud among asylum seekers. The asylum process takes years, and Trump says that people gain entry to the U.S., by saying that they want asylum and that they disappear while their cases progress in courts. Of course, critics say that Trump is very upfront about not wanting people seeking asylum to enter the United States at all, that he wants to block asylum seekers, and that this policy was one way to do that.
So a judge has stopped the Remain in Mexico policy for now. What will this mean for bureaucracy at the border?
So it's one policy, but there are plenty of other challenges that asylum seekers face at the border. One of them is that if you go up to the border and ask for asylum, you still have to get on these waiting lists. It's this metering process, they call it. And so these waiting lists are very long. They just give you a chance to go up to a border official and ask for asylum. So even with this judge's ruling this week, there's still plenty of challenges that people face at the border. And while the Trump administration struck out this week in the courts, we can expect other ways that they'll make it much tougher.
The World's Monica Campbell following the latest developments on Trump's soon-to-be-put-on-pause Remain in Mexico policy. Monica, thank you.
You're welcome.
Still on the immigration tip, the catastrophic earthquake in Haiti 9 years ago wrecked the capital and killed hundreds of thousands of people. The social and economic damage was so intense that the U.S. cut a break for Haitians who were living in the U.S. without papers. They could stay and work legally with temporary protected status, or TPS. You've probably heard that now President Trump wants to end the TPS program. Reporter Amy Bracken has a story of what ending TPS would mean for one Haitian family that's split between Boston and Haiti. One note, this family also asked not to use their real names because of their uncertain immigration status.
This is where Marie lives, in Haiti. It's in the hills just beyond the capital, where frogs sing in the afternoon.
Bonsoir, my name is Amy.
Marie's 66 years old and lives with her big family, brothers, sisters, grandchildren, in a cluster of small homes. She's in one of wood and corrugated metal. And she points to a big two-story building on the property. It's where she wants to live, but it's not done yet. It's still a concrete skeleton on the footprint of her old home, which collapsed on January 12, 2010, when the big quake hit. Marie's family survived, but their economic lifeline, a bustling restaurant, was destroyed. Marie says after the earthquake, she didn't think there was a life for them anymore. But then Marie got a break by way of her sister, Annette, 1,600 miles away in Boston.
Hi, how are you? Good.
On a Sunday, I stopped by Annette's house in a working-class area of Boston. Her family sitting down to their post-church dinner. Annette was here when the earthquake hit, but she couldn't help much because she and her family were undocumented. They'd arrived a few years before on tourist visas, which they overstayed. Life was safer in the U.S., but they struggled to make ends meet working under the table.
Good afternoon, everybody.
But after the quake, the Obama administration granted Haitians temporary protected status, or TPS.
Haitians are our neighbors in the Americas. And for Americans, they are family and friends.
More than 50,000 Haitians in the U.S. without papers could now work legally. They also joined TPS holders from places like Honduras, Nepal, Sudan, and El Salvador. With TPS, Annette's 25-year-old daughter, Ketley, could become a full-time social worker and go to grad school at night. All the adults in the family have better work now and are more rooted in the U.S.
Definitely before TPS, it was a real struggle, and I still think it is. But now, myself, my mom, my dad, my brother, we all work, so it definitely got better over time.
TPS also let them finally help their family back home with daily needs. Annette says her relatives call asking for cash for things like food. The money has also helped them rebuild. They've started a small bakery churning out dinner rolls for 10 cents apiece, and they're finally reconstructing their home. But now this progress might grind to a halt. The Trump administration claims Haiti has recovered from the earthquake and that it's time for Haitians with TPS to leave. The deadline is January 2020, but several lawsuits are fighting Trump's decision. For Ketley, Annette's daughter, the uncertainty is tough.
Like a year ago, I didn't know what to do. Like every day was like, I'm like, is something going to come out? When are they going to renew it?
She copes by praying a lot. But the prospect of either living in the U.S. undocumented again or going back to Haiti looms like a dark cloud.
I definitely think if I stay here without TPS, life will be really hard because I will not be able to work legally. I have to work to pay for school. Going back to Haiti, I don't know how life will be. I don't really know how life will be in Haiti.
If TPS ends in January, she faces going to a country she hasn't seen since she was 11 years old. In Haiti, plenty of people reject Trump's plan to end TPS. Economist Etzeri Mil says Haiti has only partially recovered from the quake and that the money Haitians overseas send home is a rare bright spot.
That's the only thing we can really rely on right now in terms of dollar sources. If we didn't have that, I don't know what the situation would be.
Today, Haiti's economy is in bad shape, even by Haitian standards. Jobs and wages are as meager as ever, and inflation is soaring. The cement for Marie's new house keeps getting more expensive. And the price of flour for her bakery? It's extreme, she says. It's tripled. I asked Marie what she thinks would happen if her family in Boston had to come back to Haiti. She says it would be crushing. There'd be no work for them. Also, the construction of Marie's new home would likely stop, and it would remain indefinitely a concrete skeleton. So she'd continue living in the shelter she still calls temporary. In January, it'll be 10 years since she lost her home and her business. It's the same month Marie's family in Boston is slated to lose their TPS status. For the World, Amy Bracken, La Boule, Haiti.
A quick update now to a story we first covered this past winter on The World. That is a captive whale. That whale's being held in a small pen near the Russian Far East city of Nakhodka on the Pacific Ocean, one of almost 100 orcas and beluga whales captured last summer, apparently for illegal sale to marine parks in China. Several may have died since then, others may be sick. Activists have been trying for months to get the Russian government to step in and rescue the whales from what they're calling a whale jail. Now for the update. The authorities have since brought charges against four companies, and they're promising to release the whales back into the wild if they can.
They've decided to see how we could eventually rehabilitate them and hopefully release them.
That's marine activist Jean-Michel Cousteau, yes, of that Cousteau family. He's part of a group of activists and scientists who've signed a deal with the Russian government to try to help the whales learn to live again in the wild. Cousteau says the goal is to release all of them. But activist Charles Vinnick, who's also part of the effort, thinks that won't be quick or easy.
Not only do we have to understand the health conditions of each whale, we also have to look at where it is appropriate to transport them so that they can be having the best opportunity to have food and guidance of older adults.
Vinnick helped lead the effort to free a captive orca named Keiko in 2002, you know, of Free Willy fame. Keiko's release in Iceland was widely publicized, but what most people may not remember is that it ultimately failed. Scientists say Keiko never really learned to socialize with other orcas or find his own food. And he died after about 18 months back in the wild. So the challenge of freeing these 97 whales in Russia is pretty big. And the activists say they don't yet have a plan for rehabilitating them. So no happy ending yet to the story of Russia's whale jail, but a ray of hope. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. There's this image from the protests in Sudan that's gone viral on social media. It shows a young woman standing on top of a car. There's a large crowd of protesters surrounding her. There's also video of this moment. People have been trying to figure out who this woman is and what the story is behind the photo. That includes the world's own Shirin Jafari. She's here to tell us more. What have you found, Shirin?
It's a striking photo, Marco. It looks like it was taken at sunset. So there's this beautiful, warm light. And this woman is standing on the roof of a white car. Her index finger is pointing to the sky, and she's surrounded by a sea of protesters, mostly women. And these people are holding their cell phones up, kind of like directed at her, and they're taking videos and photos of her.
Yeah, I mean, this photo is like a still from a motion picture. I was also struck by what she's wearing.
Yeah, there's a lot of symbolism surrounding that outfit. She's in a white thobe, some people also call it tobe. That's the traditional outer garment that Sudanese women wear. Mary Grace Brown is a professor at Brown University, and she's written a book about fashion and body politics in Sudan. And she told me that by wearing the white thobe, this woman is evoking the fashion of the past generations.
Beginning in the 1940s and 50s, Sudanese women activists consciously wore the white thobe as a modest garment that was a way of standing in sort of contrast to their radical and outspoken demands.
And Marco, it's not just the dress, but also the earrings that this woman is wearing. She has these gold circular earrings called moon earrings, and they're glowing in the afternoon light.
Jewelry has been the means by which Sudanese women hold their wealth, so that jewelry is passed on from mother to daughter. And so that addition of that gold earring is also evoking women's wealth and also women's domestic power.
So, Shirin, what do we know exactly about the woman standing on the car in her thobe? Who is she?
Well, since the photo went viral, she's been in high demand and everybody's been trying to reach her, but it's really difficult to reach Khartoum these days. Connections are really poor. But for about a day or so on my Twitter feed, nobody knew who she was, and people kept asking, who is this woman, and trying to find out answers about who this woman is. And then Arabic media reported that her name is Ala Saleh, and she's a 22-year-old student studying engineering and architecture at Sudan International University.
And what do you know about the person who took the photo?
So the photo was taken by Lana Haroon. She's a photographer and musician based in Khartoum.
What about the context in which this photo was taken? There are a lot of Sudanese people fed up with the government there and protesting.
Absolutely. There's been ongoing protests in Sudan since last December, and things have been really intensifying over the past few days. There have been mass sit-ins outside the presidential compound and the army headquarters in Khartoum. And this woman on the car, she was leading one of these protests. And in fact, women have been at the forefront of the protests across Sudan.
So pulling back, Shirin, what would you say is the significance of this image? And what does Ala Saleh, the woman in the photo, really mean for the Sudanese people?
Well, just listen to what Hind Makki, a Sudanese-American in Chicago, told me about this.
I think any Sudanese person would see this photograph, see this image, and immediately remember, you know, their mother or their aunt or their grandmother who's going out to work. And so there's a nostalgic element to the photo. And I think it represents a certain kind of Sudanese empowered femininity. And I think for young Sudanese women to see that, yeah, certainly they identify or they can identify with that.
Hind told me that she personally identified with this photo as a Sudanese American.
I would bet any woman who's seen this photo would identify with it. I mean, she looks like the Statue of Liberty.
That's true. And you can see for yourself on our website, we have the photo and the social media reaction from people who've been captivated by this image of Ala Saleh. That's at theworld.org.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for telling us about this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Here's a big question many people around the world are trying to answer. How do you keep fake news and disinformation off of social media, especially around elections? Rema Rajeshwari spends a lot of her day thinking about this. She's a police chief in the southern Indian state of Telangana, where she oversees about 700 villages.
Because of the socioeconomic background of the region, people need to be taught how to behave in social media. And this region is predisposed to violence. And especially during elections, we need to be extra vigilant.
In the past, she told us, fake news and rumors that spread through the messaging platform WhatsApp have led to violence, even death. And while social media platforms are coming up with technical fixes to deal with the problem, Rajeshwari has devised her own low-tech program to combat fake news in her district. She's ramping up that program as India begins its month-long national elections tomorrow.
I have a social media monitoring cell, a group of tech-savvy police officers who keep a constant watch on the social media platforms in the district. And anytime we get a notification about a fake message being spread, going viral and creating disruption in the society, we respond instantly. We initiate legal action, number one. Number two, as part of the intensive educative campaign that I do, we take the help of town criers, basically drummers. We teach them to convey the message on our behalf. So they go around all these villages along with the village police officers to tell the people not to take law into their hands if they have any apprehension after watching probably a viral video in a WhatsApp group. So it is their responsibility to inform the police about it and not to resort to violence. And third, I have a dedicated folk team, a group of police officers who can sing and dance. We go around all these remote villages teaching people through songs not to fall for these fake news, especially during elections.
I mean, it's unique. Are you finding that you're getting positive results from this low-tech approach to fake news?
Absolutely. So the other day I was doing a data analytics about poll violence that was recorded in the 2014 elections. And very recently, we had the state assembly elections towards the end of 2018, and we had the local body elections in the beginning of 2019. So when we did a comparative analysis of the poll violence that was recorded during elections, we witnessed a drastic reduction in the number of cases that were registered, and especially in the villages where these programs were conducted. So definitely it is effective. And also I'm using a local storytelling tradition called as Janapadam. It's a local oral storytelling tradition. When I use this in law enforcement to convey a message to the people, they're able to identify my message better. Mm. So it is definitely a very effective policing intervention that came quite handy for us.
That's fascinating. Rema Rajeshwari is a police chief in the southern Indian state of Telangana, where she oversees about 700 villages. Thank you very much, and good luck with the filtering out the fake news.
Thank you so much, Marco. It was nice talking to you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. The measles outbreak in New York City connects to a vicious outbreak in Ukraine. Vaccination rates are high there right now.
But the question isn't where are they now, it's where have they been for the last 10 years, because there's been terrible under-vaccination in Ukraine.
How Ukraine became the measles hotspot in Europe. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. New York City's measles outbreak has prompted dramatic measures. The city is requiring people to get vaccinated in one hard-hit part of the city or face a $1,000 fine. Measles is preventable with vaccination, but the disease can spread fast in areas with low vaccination rates. The World Health Organization believes travelers to Ukraine may be connected to the New York outbreak, as well as outbreaks in Israel and the UK. But why does Ukraine have such a big problem? Meredith Wadman took that question on earlier this year in the magazine Science. She's also the author of The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. Meredith, just how low are the vaccination rates in Ukraine?
Well, as we speak, Marco, they have come right back up to where they need to be, close to 95%. But the question isn't where are they now, it's where have they been for the last 10 years, because there's been terrible under-vaccination in Ukraine since 2007 or 8. And when that happens, when you're getting only, in some years, 50% of kids immunized, you have basically begun building a pool of under-immunized children. And when the virus takes hold, it spreads wildly. And it doesn't matter if you're vaccinating 95% of your one-year-olds when, you know, only 30% of your six-year-olds have been vaccinated. And that's, in effect, what happened in Ukraine over the last decade or so.
I was looking at a chart earlier today, and it looks like Ukraine's measles rates are off the charts. Compare the cases in Ukraine with the rest of Europe.
Well, there are issues in other European countries like Greece, like Italy, but those are single-digit thousands. In the Ukraine, we're talking tens of thousands. We're talking more than 80,000 cases in Ukraine in the last 18 months, including more than 15,000 just in the first month of this year. So it's a grave situation.
So how did it get to this point? How did we get here?
What happened was in 2008, a 17-year-old boy died after receiving a measles vaccination in Ukraine. UNICEF and the World Health Organization determined after an investigation that his death was unrelated to the vaccine. It didn't matter. Helped by a credulous media, the myth that measles vaccine was going to kill you took root and spread. And so you saw 97% of one-year-olds vaccinated in Ukraine in 2007. That fell to 56% by 2010.
Wow.
And you need 95% of kids vaccinated to keep measles at bay. It is an incredibly infectious disease. If you enter a room with a bunch of unvaccinated people and you're carrying measles, you're going to infect 12 to 18 of them. It's remarkable. And so to contain it, you have to have those vaccination rates high. And Ukraine had trouble recovering. They began to recover from the anti-vaccine sentiment slowly up till about 2013. Then a revolution and a war intervened. The government became paralyzed. It failed to order measles vaccine. And so by 2016, it was just an epidemic waiting to happen.
Measles in Ukraine is a problem for the rest of the world. What's the connection between people from the U.S. making a religious pilgrimage to Ukraine last fall?
Well, actually, it was mainly, I believe, people from Israel, tens of thousands of Orthodox men traveling to Uman, a Ukrainian city where there's the grave of a famous father of Hasidic Jewry. And they took the disease with them back then to Israel. And thence it spread to Brooklyn and Rockland County in New York. Separately, it's believed that a trip to Ukraine seeded the epidemic that, or the outbreak rather, that occurred in Western Washington State this year, which fortunately it looks like has finally been contained.
Yeah, so then the question is, how hard is it to ensure herd immunity when the whole planet is so connected and porous?
It's difficult. And in a lot of the global south, the issue is not vaccine resistance or vaccine hesitancy. It's poor infrastructure and poverty keeping lots of kids, particularly from being vaccinated. But in Europe and in particularly Ukraine, and then I'm sorry to say in spots in the United States, it's vaccine refusal that has become the issue. The World Health Organization declared vaccine hesitancy a top 10 global health priority for 2019. It's on that agency's agenda. It's certainly got to be on all of our minds.
Meredith Wadman, author of The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Cost of Defeating Disease, also a reporter for the magazine Science. Thank you, Meredith.
It's been a pleasure, Marco. Thanks for having me.
In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has emerged as the winner in yesterday's general election. His main challenger, Benny Gantz of the Blue and White Party, conceded defeat today. Netanyahu is now on course to become Israel's longest-serving prime minister ever, and he's expected to form a solidly right-wing governing coalition in Israel's parliament. That trend toward the right is one of the reasons that the American Jewish community's relationship with Israel's government is increasingly fraught. Some see the divide as generational. That includes 24-year-old Alyssa Rubin, a community organizer living in Boston. Rubin is a member of If Not Now, a Jewish anti-occupation movement. That is a source of anguish for her grandfather, 86-year-old Jason Pearl, a lawyer in Bloomfield, Connecticut.
I have spent a great deal of time with Alyssa as she was growing up, and it comes as quite a shock to me that she could have an attitude toward Israel different from grandpa's.
For many years, grandfather and granddaughter have been debating U.S. policy toward Israel. Today, they're letting us listen in.
When I was about 8 to 10, I was at a men's breakfast in my synagogue, and someone who had, in fact, escaped from Europe was telling the men assembled there on a Sunday morning, telling them about the annihilation of European Jewry. And they castigated this man. They yelled at him, liar, it's not true, the Germans would never do this. I mean, they were vituperative toward this man, that it was impossible that the Germans were bent on annihilating European Jewry. I grew up knowing there was this great need for a land that would accept Jews. Alyssa doesn't have that experience. She knows that she's intellectually brilliant, and she knows these things happen, but she didn't live through them, and there's a big difference.
Alyssa, you didn't live through the 30s and 40s. Do you agree with your grandfather that you see the world differently because of that, because of the time you grew up in?
Yeah, we've had this conversation a lot of times, and it's really helped me to ground in the perspective of somebody that grew up during a really different time. And I think a major shift that's happened over the last few years, particularly since Trump's election and the growth of this right-wing white nationalist movement, is that I've really started seeing anti-Semitism expressed in this country in a more visceral way than I've ever experienced it before. And I think where the difference lies is that I see the U.S. and Trump's relationship with the Israeli government and with Netanyahu as fueling that anti-Semitism and not protecting us from it.
It's hard. It's hard for me to have my granddaughter support organizations which are, to my mind, anti-Israel and, to her mind, constructive toward improving Israel. I think that's a fair statement. They can't hear the shake of your head, dear, on the radio.
Thank you for the visual.
It feels like a tension for me to know that I don't believe that the way that Israel is currently set up or the way that our whole world order is set up is really living out the values of Judaism. And I acknowledge the really deep historical connection that we have to this place, and having been there has been a really complicated experience for me, and I also did feel this sense of connection.
And Jason Pearl, do you feel that same tension as your granddaughter?
When I taught Hebrew school, which is, you know, 60, 70 years ago, wow, I can't believe it's that long ago, Israel was something that one didn't question as a nation. It's almost my country, right or wrong, my country. And if the price of having Israel is that we rarely question its internal and external policies, then that's the price I think we ought to be willing to pay.
To me, if we don't criticize Israel, we don't hold Bibi accountable, we don't hold our people and the American Jews that support Israel unquestioningly, then we ourselves are putting ourselves in a dangerous situation where right now the mainstream Jewish community is allying itself with Trump and with anti-Semites and white nationalists, all in the name of protecting and supporting Israel. And so I think that we make this implicit assumption that Israel equals Jews and Jews' safety equals Israel. And I feel like in this moment, there's actually been a shift where Israel and its current, in the way that Israel is currently operating, is actually making us less safe. And I believe that Jews and all people deserve to be safe. And no, I will fight for that. I just don't think that the way that things are going right now, that safety is in Israel.
Let me just jump in, because it's a great moment to pivot back to the elections in Israel. The latest results suggest Benjamin Netanyahu will continue to be the prime minister, now the longest serving one in Israeli history, passing even the record tenure of David Ben-Gurion. Exit polling also shows that Trump was an asset for Netanyahu, especially the recognition of the Golan Heights being a main feather in Bibi's cap. How does that color your view of Israeli relations with the U.S. today, both of you?
On a very, very personal level, I am so proud of Alyssa. I am so proud that she is my granddaughter. On the other hand, I would like to see her devote her efforts to put all of her desires to make change directed against the people who are lobbing rockets from Gaza into civilian homes in Israel. Go after those people. Change their ways rather than go after the people who are trying to defend themselves.
The reason that I'm focused on the Jewish community is because I'm a Jew and because this is being done in our name.
Jason, what do you think the younger generation is failing to see, briefly? And then Alyssa, same question to you.
I know that the existence of a strong Israel is necessary for the Jewish diaspora to have any security. Alyssa doesn't know what it means to have no nation in the world willing to accept her because she has a big J on her passport.
And what do you think the older generation is missing, Alyssa?
I believe that this absolutely devastating trauma happened to us, and we acted in a way that we needed to at the time to heal that trauma and to be safe. But in the process, and as the global context has changed, as the reality has changed, that we are now in deep danger because of the very thing that we tried to protect ourselves with. I care just as much about the Jewish community as you do, and I care about Jews being safe. And I see that there's another choice. I see that the only choices that we've been presented to keep ourselves safe are assimilate, reject our Judaism, assimilate into white American Christian society, or go to Israel. And I think that in the diaspora, there's another choice, that those don't have to be our two choices, that we can choose to claim our Judaism and also be in solidarity with the other groups that are targeted by white nationalism and white supremacy in this country and actually ally ourselves rather than separating ourselves and allying with people who we think will keep us safe but actually do not care about us. And I think that we also really need to look at the way that the U.S. is responsible in a lot of ways for the current situation, and that it's actually quite beneficial for the U.S. for Israel to be administering a military occupation. And looking at the way that the U.S. really profits off of the occupation and has a really vested interest in the status quo being maintained in Israel.
Well, why don't you take responsibility for the oppression in Syria? Why don't you take oppression for all the civilians around the world who are being gassed, who are being made homeless? I see an area where you could devote your somewhat brilliant efforts without being contra, I won't say anti, contra-Jewish, contra-Zion, contra-Israeli.
I think this is the most Jewish thing I can do, though, is to engage in these conversations and in these questions and take responsibility. And I think that you can hear me as little as maybe you do. I think that you can hear me in a way that you might not hear somebody who's not Jewish, because you know that I care, because well, I have a vested stake in it.
See, I'm not so sure. When you start criticizing the very existence of Israel as it exists today, then I'm not so sure that you're doing it from a pro-Jewish point of view. It scares me. It bothers me. It's, you know, trouble in the tribe.
Clearly, the conversation doesn't end here. Alyssa Rubin and her grandfather, Jason Pearl, thanks very much for letting us be privy to some of it.
We will continue our discussion.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you both.
But we respect each other.
There are tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans who fled the island after Hurricane Maria. There are hundreds of thousands of people displaced by Cyclone Idai in southern Africa. Just two recent examples of people turned into climate refugees. It is not an official legal designation, but David Wallace Wells estimates there are about 10 to 20 million people in the world today who are displaced because of climate change. Wallace Wells is the author of the book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, and he warns that the number of people forced from their homes by consequences of climate change will only increase.
Well, I think the most dramatic threat when it comes to climate refugees is actually just direct heat. As soon as 2050, it's expected that some of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East are going to become so hot that it will be impossible to move around outside, certainly work outside, without suffering a risk of heat stroke and possibly death. Mm. And that means that cities that today are home to 10, 12, 15 million people may become functionally unlivable, at least in summer, just a few decades from now. The UN projects that by 2050, in part because of these direct heat effects, in part because of flooding, we're almost certain to see at least 200 million climate refugees. That is a level of chaos, of human chaos, that we have really no precedent for in human history.
So how can countries plan for this? I mean, more importantly, given the hostility to refugees in many countries, will they plan for this?
climate change is not just a matter of science and what the climate system will do. It's also a matter of how we'll respond and how our lives and our civilizations will be shaped by these forces. I think that carbon will be at the very center of geopolitics very quickly, so that if you imagine, you know, the new international order that was built after World War II being built on the principle of human rights and peace and prosperity. That order didn't always honor those values, but they were the stated goals of basically all international cooperation. I think as soon as a decade from now, that will be the case with climate. All of our trade agreements will deal with carbon. We'll perhaps start to see sanctions imposed on countries who are behaving poorly, and possibly even military intervention to deal with nations who are behaving really irresponsibly. And I know that sounds so wild to contemplate, but if you had told a European in 1915 that we'd be fighting wars over human rights as soon as three or four decades down the line, they would have laughed at you too.
Do you think authoritarians will be given a pass on human rights by the world community if they accept climate refugees and take climate change seriously?
And I think that it's possible that we see more authoritarianism in parts of the world as a way of dealing with climate, and that we turn a blind eye to people who are behaving poorly towards their own citizens if they're doing other things that we value, in the same way that we've done in the past with human rights. And I think ultimately China will be the biggest test case of this. Xi Jinping is a man who has jailed probably several million Muslims in Xinjiang and has built a quite intense surveillance state, but at the same time has been making much more dramatic commitments, at least at the rhetorical level, to climate action and green energy. We will see how the West responds to those different impulses.
We're speaking with David Wallace Wells, the author of The Uninhabitable Earth. Even a 2-degree rise, experts say, will be catastrophic, and it's easy to imagine massive chaos after human displacement. When you talk about people leaving, are you considering the people who have means, leaving many poor people to try and survive in unlivable conditions?
Well, that's always the problem. I mean, the people who are already well off will find ways to endure, and those who have less will suffer most. Unfortunately, the impacts of climate change are distributed in that way too, such that the global south is already being hit much harder than the global north. Even though climate change is a universal, all-encompassing system, it will punish us unequally. If we continue on the track we're on, there'll be parts of the world that could be hit by 6 climate-driven natural disasters at once.
Wow.
Globally, we could have agricultural yields that are about half as bountiful as the ones that we have today. We'd probably be trying to feed about 50% more people. Again, it's the wealthy nations of the world that will probably find a way to navigate around those challenges. Unfortunately, I think we're already seeing that the wealthy of the world's first instinct is to sort of turn their back on the suffering of the global south, as we're seeing with that horrible weather event in Mozambique, which entirely wiped out a city of 500,000 people.
So you've suggested that science fiction and dystopian fiction might actually have some lessons for us on how to deal with all this, or at least how to think about all this. What is the connection from The Hunger Games to like surviving this?
Well, I hope that we don't get all the way to that kind of a scenario, but I think it is important.
Yeah, that's pretty drastic.
I think it's a useful reminder that we will almost certainly endure, and I think that it's up to us to design that future, I think most importantly by deciding how we manage carbon emissions, because by far the most important driver of how warm it's going to get is how much carbon we're putting into the atmosphere. So it is up to us to write the future acts of this story. And when we think about some of these horrifying impacts that we could be dealing with at 3, 4, 5 degrees of warming, they can seem overwhelming, they can seem paralyzing, but ultimately they're a reminder of how much power we retain over the climate. I don't think that this is a binary thing where either we're going to end up in a utopia or a dystopia. I think almost certainly, as is always the case, we're going to end up somewhere in between. We can choose to really redraw and reorient our politics to address this issue head on as the overwhelming, all-encompassing, and preeminent challenge of our time, which frankly, it is. We need a politics that treats it that way.
It is a fascinating and urgent discussion. David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Finally today, a note on international collaboration in an age when countries seem to be separating and walling themselves off. A group of scientists from roughly 20 countries has this landmark announcement today after a decade of working together.
We are delighted to be able to report to you today that we have seen what we thought was unseeable.
That's Shep Dolman, head of the Event Horizon Telescope Program, at a press conference today.
We have seen and taken a picture of a black hole. Here it is.
The picture shows a fiery-looking ring around a dark circle. The black hole is 55 million light-years away, and it is 3 million times bigger than Earth. No single telescope was powerful enough to capture the image, so Dolman and an international group of researchers networked 8 telescopes together.
We worked for over a decade to link telescopes around the globe to make an Earth-sized virtual dish. We have telescopes from Hawaii to Arizona to Mexico to Chile to the South Pole and Spain.
All those telescopes turned in the same direction 2 years ago to pool their power for a super high-resolution image.
It's the equivalent of being able to read the date on a quarter in Los Angeles when we're standing here in Washington, D.C.
Wow. All the data gathered by the telescopes was too big to be transmitted online, so it was flown on hard drives to processing centers in the U.S. and Germany. And when that data was finally processed into one image, Dolman says he was filled with wonder.
To see something for the first time, you know, to know that you've uncovered part of the universe that was off limits to us. When that happens, it's an extraordinary feeling.
Harvard astrophysicist Shep Dolman speaking today about the first ever photograph of a black hole. And Dolman says it should serve as a model for how to make international collaboration work. And that's our show for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. If we don't get sucked into antimatter, we'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.